For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave.
Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell and our faithful production manager. Well, we won't even look for a nickname for you today, Jim, but Jim Ganley, our production manager with us today. And today, Tim, as we're recording, is the feast day of the beheading of John the Baptist.
Yes.
And this time of year, end of summer, beginning of the school year, the church has just some fantastic feast days.
August is full of great feast days. In fact, earlier, we actually had a holy day of obligation with the Assumption. We had the Queenship of Mary on the 22nd, which is actually another fascinating feast because it actually ties into Our Lady of Knock apparition.
As an Irishman has to bring up Our Lady of Knock.
That's right, which actually occurred on the 21st of August, but the 21st of August was already taken by St. Pius X. So that's why we celebrate the queenship on the 22nd of August. But now, rolling right along, again, a month just packed, full of great saints. We have two of the most prominent, I think, and certainly favorite saints of many, many Catholics. And that is, it's a mother-son team.
Exactly.
Of St. Monica and St. Augustine of Hippo.
Exactly. And, you know, there was I noticed at one of the local parishes, I think there was a rosary group of women that got together for the feast day of St. Monica to pray for their children, for their grandchildren. You know, St. Monica notoriously prayed St. Augustine into the church, and she's an emblem of that persistence in prayer. In particular, of a mother for her children, but I was thinking about this, that G.K. Chesterton mentioned in relation to St. Francis, that each era, each time frame seems to have a fascination with a saint that doesn't necessarily fit the time period when you think about it, but is needed by that time period. Like Victorian England, for some reason, was totally taken with St. Francis. And you couldn't think of two more opposites than your typical Victorian English gentleman and St. Francis.
Right.
But, basically, Victorian England needed St. Francis. They needed that example of, lightening up a little bit.
Right.
And I feel like St. Monica's kind of the same way. You know, she's a very popular saint right now. And I think it's a sign of our times to a certain extent that we need St. Monica figures in today's day and age.
Yeah. I mean, it's, as you mentioned, she's certainly the patroness for parents to pray, to ask for her intercession specifically for the conversion of their children. Their general well-being obviously is included in that, but that's the thing. So often, as a parent, if we have children who have strayed away from the faith, then maybe they just weren't raised in the faith, and then as an adult you convert, and then you want your family to come along with. Into the Holy Catholic Church, we ask for St. Monica's intercession for the conversion of our children. And so that's a perennial need. Maybe that's why she stays so popular, because unfortunately the drifting away is a phenomenon that has been with us ever since her time and probably will be with us till the end.
Yeah, and as a dad, I have to say, as far as all of those dad things that you do to try to raise good kids, praying for my kids is one that I often neglect. You know, it's one that I often forget about, of, you know, spending that daily time making sure that I'm praying for each of my kids by name, praying for their needs, what they need, etc. So St. Monica is a great reminder of how important that is.
Are you sure you're overlooking that? Because I can imagine you have kind of a big family there, Mark, and I can just picture you at home going, "Good Lord, what'd you do now?" I would imagine there's a lot of prayers like that going around at the Tuttle House.
I guess those are sort of prayers when you think about it.
Right.
Well, anyway, what we want to talk about today, though, isn't St. Monica, but St. Monica's son.
Yes.
St. Augustine, whom she threw.
Not Augustine, for those who are listening.
Right, exactly.
That's sort of like a giveaway. I think if someone says Augustine, I kind of suspect they're not Catholic.
Yes. You know, there's two.
That's what everyone else calls
there's
them.
There's two saints like that. They're St. Augustine. When you say Augustine,
you're
talking about the saint.
Yes.
And when you say Augustine, you're talking about the grass. St. Yes. Augustine grass, right?
Or there's that, that's a city in Florida too,
right.
I think.
And similarly, when you say St. Bernard, you're talking about the saint.
St. Bernard of Clairvaux.
And when you say St. Bernard, you're talking about a dog.
Correct. You're right. That is the other giveaway.
Right, exactly.
Bernard and Bernard.
Bernard, right. But we are going to talk about St. Augustine today. And particularly, I want to talk a little bit. So St. Augustine's life, you know, he didn't really, I guess he kind of reverted, but he didn't really fully embrace the Catholic faith until he was in his mid-30s.
Right.
And so he had lived a life of seeking and a lifelong search for truth, which is very much a philosophical model for us. And through that search and through the combination of St. Monica's prayers that we were talking about earlier, he eventually found the truth embedded in the teachings of the Catholic Church. But it was a long journey.
Yes. And I think that's what makes St. Monica so interesting and attractive to us, is that she saw that he was a seeker of the truth. I think that's emblematic of his life's commitment, right? Was to seek the truth with a capital T.
He was also a man for his season. So he was a particular saint at a particular time in history that I think allowed for him to have that kind of intellectual search, which then, once he finally embraced the truth of Catholicism, he was then able to use that to be an immense treasure of philosophical knowledge, of teaching, of catechism, that the church is still, I think, being rewarded for his faithfulness and for his seeking.
Yeah, and just to sort of place him in history, because we're going to unpack all that you just laid out there, Mark, in this program, but just to sort of situate him, he was born in the 13th of November, 354, and then he died on the 28th of August, which is why we have his feast day on the 28th, in the year 430.
Right, and so what happened between those is key to understanding St. Augustine. Towards the end of his life, Rome was sacked by the Germanic hordes. Now I have to, you were playing up your Irish heritage. My German heritage comes into play here. And so the Germanic tribes came and they eventually conquered Rome and sacked Rome. And this was,
it was Attila the Hun, was it not?
I don't know if no, I don't think that was.
Oh, that was
Attila.
Later.
Yeah,
that was
Attila
later.
Was later. So this was, Alaric sticks in the back of my mind as the one that sacked Rome, but I'm not sure the exact German chieftain that did it at that point. But nonetheless, Rome fell, and this would really be for the Roman Empire. If you take the attacks on the Twin Towers on 9/11, and you multiply that as far as a tragic just sort of worldwide tragedy that the rest of the world kind of reacted to in shock and horror and just it was beyond belief that something like this could happen. That's what the fall of Rome was.
Yeah, it reminds me of that expression from the word that comes to mind, that the sacking of Rome is from a Princess Bride. Inconceivable.
Right, exactly.
Inconceivable.
It was inconceivable that Rome would ever
fall. It was called
fall.
The Eternal City.
Yeah, it was the Eternal City. You know, Virgil wrote
it'd been
the
around
Aeneid.
Like, it had been like 600-700 years it'd been around.
Right. And, you know, the whole point of Virgil's Aeneid is that the greatness of Rome has been prophesied since the beginning of the world.
Right.
That, you know, I mean, that's the whole reason Virgil wrote the Aeneid, was to drive that home, that the right. greatness of Rome, you know, that this was, yeah, supposed to be an eternal city, an everlasting city. And yet somehow the barbarian hordes got through and they were able to sack the city. And, yeah, the tragic fallout of that was inconceivable. And yet, the reaction to that, which is all too human, is to try to figure out who's to blame for this.
Yeah, how, you know, how did it happen?
How did it happen, and what happened, and who's to blame for it? And as was common in that time period, the blame fell on the Christians.
Yes, it sure did. In fact, that sort of unleashed several subsequent Caesars to initiate persecutions of the Christians again, which there was a cessation, right, following the Edict of Milan, right, in 313, I think it was, AD, there was a cessation of persecution. Christianity had become tolerated, let's say. It wasn't and so during Augustine time, it's very interesting because he's born not long after Emperor Constantine dies, and then lives through this, among other things, lives through this inconceivable catastrophe, the fall of Rome, and that marks his death. St. Augustine's death is by historians about the time period that people mark the quote unquote end of the Roman Empire, is right around that time period. So he's living during, as they say, very interesting times, to say the
least. Yeah, very interesting times, to say the least. And his upbringing, like I said, he really delayed coming into the fullness of the faith.
I think it's fair to say he, as he was that seeker of truth, he was trained as really as, I think we would call it more of a, almost like a professional public speaker.
Right. So he would be the I think in a lot of ways, he would be the equivalent of a high profile university professor.
Something along those lines. Yeah, that would be, but before there were universities, so they had to freelance basically, you know, selling their services to, you know, nobles, or there would be public forums and things like that. But yeah, and he was a especially gifted orator, right? He would, issues of the day would be debated, for example, in the public square. He's known for embracing on this path into the church. He's known for embracing a heresy called Manichaeism. So he becomes a disciple of Manichae. And that is a very interesting heresy. And like most heresies, Mark, they're never really vanquished. And they often just reappear in new and often ghastly apparitions and have manifest themselves with. They're still with us, and they look a little, they're in a different guise.
Right. And, you know, we're going to have to take a quick break here. But when we come back, Tim, let's talk a little bit more about just the nature of heresy and why that is that heresies never ever really seem to totally, completely go away. You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy. We'll be right back.
It's not too early to sign up for our Catholic Radio annual dinner. This year's dinner will be on Tuesday, October 2nd at the Northside Knights of Columbus Hall near 71st and Keystone. Archbishop Charles Thompson will be our guest speaker. There'll be a silent auction, a live auction, some great food, and a chance to meet the staff and board members of Catholic Radio Indy. You can sign up right now at catholicradioindy.org or by giving us a call at 317-870-8400.
Welcome back to The Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle, still here with Timothy O'Donnell.
You betcha.
Jim Ganley here in the cave.
The big man himself.
And we are talking about St. Augustine. St. Augustine's feast day was earlier this week. And you know, St. Augustine contributed so much to the intellectual heritage of the church in general, the Western church in particular. Mm-hmm. And so one of the key things that he left for us was this ability to confront errors as they arise within church history. And the same errors have a habit of coming back again and again and again and again. And I think it's just sort of the nature of heresy to a certain extent that heresy itself is going to repeat. You know, it's addressed once. The answers are given. It's condemned. The heretics are dealt with.
That's taking different forms.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. So you know,
handed over to the state typically.
Handed over to the state possibly. You know, so differing ways that the church has dealt with heresy throughout history. Some of it is not necessarily.
Some pretty tough by
exactly
by today's standards. Right. Some of it was,
but nonetheless, you know, heresy is dealt with, and then it comes back in. Similar errors, but maybe in a different, slightly different form. And so one of those reoccurring heresies that seems to come up over and over again is the one that St. Augustine fell into for a while, and then after he converted, was able to address, and that is Manichaeism.
Right. And Manichaeism is it's still with us today. It's got maybe a couple of different forms that we can talk about, but Manichaeism is... I think generally understood to be a theological framework in which you have two equal but opposing supreme beings, one good and one evil.
Right.
And so this is you can see this this concept outside of Christianity too. You can see it for example, there's some Eastern religions where you have the yin and the yang, you know, anywhere you see a manifestation of a transcendent power or deities that are one good and one bad, if you will, and that are in a kind of locked in an eternal combat, if you will, is a kind of Manichaeism.
Right, and I would even say that it doesn't have to be opposing deities necessarily. That when you have two conceptions of good and evil where they're equal, and you know the whole idea is you have to balance the good and the evil, and that they conflict with each other.
That is the premise of the League of Shadows from the Dark Knight trilogy by Christopher Nolan. That's the whole point.
So you've been spending a little bit more time in the cave lately than
right,
I have been.
The Bat Cave.
Tim, I'm thinking you may need to get out a little bit
right.
more.
Well, I haven't been feeling good, so I have been home. So I have been watching more Netflix than I normally would. So that's why that came right to top of my
mind. You know
I did just watch that because it actually, what spurred me to watch it was I was reading – one of my favorite publications is National Catholic Register, and I was reading that, and they had a it was a 10-year – it's a 10-year anniversary of the Dark Knight, and so they had a big kind of expose on it. I'm like, you know, I had seen the trilogy before, but it's been only when it came out and only once. When it came out in theaters, only once. So I wasn't – so I did just finish watching all three. And there are incredible biblical references and themes that run through that. For example, Batman is a kind of Job. Not to get us too far off our today's topic,
right?
But
yeah,
but that you know we gotta bring back a Job. But he's also just quick. He's also if you think about the petitions to God to save, when God condemned Sodom and Gomorrah to be destroyed, you have the prayers of Abraham, right? That, well, what if there's, you know, one good person? What about 10? And that's kind of how the Dark Knight sees Gotham City, that yes, it's overrun with corruption and evil and crime and violence. But despite that, it's still worth saving.
Right, because there's at least a small number of
good people.
Good people that need the intervention of the Dark Knight.
Correct. Yeah. So we'll have to get Dr. Jason Eberle. We haven't had him on the show in a while. And maybe visit that and maybe some other some other shows. But I bring that up because getting back to St. Augustine this and Manichaeism, you know, one of the ways, you know, that a manifestation of that is often pointed to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or the Mormons, seem to have a theological structure that has strong elements of Manichaeism in it.
Right, and Manichaeism, when you sit down and you start to think about it, it's a natural error to make. It's a natural error to look at the world and see the evil that's out there and think of it as a force in itself, as something that has being in itself, has existence, that really is an actual thing that is in competition and is battling against good, and that it's our job as good people to push back and battle against the evil, and that it really is sort of a war between good and evil, and that this war then, you know, is probably controlled by forces that are outside our own control. And so, you know, it's a very easy error to fall in. And what St. Augustine famously kind of pointed out about it is the error is seeing evil as something that actually exists, as something that actually has existence and being, when really evil is just simply the absence of goodness. And right. And then the absence of the presence of God.
Right. And it's easy. I think myself as a kid, I don't know, 10 years old or something like that, you know, it's easy, say at that age, to think, okay, well, you know, in one hand I have my Jesus doll, and in the other hand I have my Satan doll, and they just fight, you know, just like G.I. Joes, you know, they're just on different teams. Because we think of them as persons in that sense. But a more so Augustine falls into this Manichaeism. He has some other heresies that he falls into. And it's and I guess what I, even though he's fallen into heresy, what I think, what I know, what I admire, and I think a lot of others do too, is he is a relentless pursuer and seeker of the truth. So he doesn't stop having in his error. He's always thirsting for more, to possess more and more of the truth of things. So by that propelling him forward, he eventually makes his way to Milan, and which is really interesting, because the, you know, so often I think when we think of the Holy Catholic Church at that period, and even for centuries, we tend to think primarily of like Italy and we forget that there's many, many, many great saints from across the Mediterranean, including the continent of Africa.
Right, because, you know,
from the beginning.
Yeah, because the expanse of the Roman Empire was such that, you know, it was all one civilization. So you have early, you know, I would say they're myths. I mean, some of them there's probably more truth behind them than others. But you have early myths of various saints from the Bible, the, you know, New Testament characters, winding up in Spain and southern France and mm-hmm. other places that you would think, well, how on earth could Mary Magdalene have wound up in southern France? But, you know, the expanse of the Roman Empire was such that, no, that actually could have happened and, you know, in some cases very likely did.
Yeah, and you think, and that was one of the, part of the genius of God's providential plan is that by sowing the seeds of Christianity in Jerusalem and it being a part of the Roman Empire, it's that Pax Romana, the peace of Rome or the Roman Empire, and its system of highways and commerce that allowed Christianity to spread and the exchange of ideas. It's what helped make St. Paul's journeys possible, because he was traveling within the Roman Empire. And then also it's worth mentioning that Alexandria, when you think, again, going back to Africa, Alexandria is in Egypt. And Alexandria is one of the five original patriarchal cities, along with Jerusalem, Rome, Constantinople, and I'm going to draw a blank on the fifth one. It's in Syria, Antioch. So those are the five. And kind of, and you think about, if you think of in a map, if you look at a map, or if you're familiar with where those are located, they do kind of create. If you put a star on those, it does kind of give you a sense of where the Roman Empire was at that time.
Right, right. And then you look at Hippo and Carthage and sort of that North African part of the Roman Empire, and you realize kind of how far away from those centers Hippo and Carthage actually was. So
right.
It wasn't exactly a backwater, but it was close. It was, you know, where Augustine grew up, and he was his father was a nobleman. So where Augustine grew up was not like the center of center of commerce and the center of
he was more on the outskirts.
Exactly.
For sure.
Yep, exactly.
For sure.
And then wanted to move quickly into the center. Mm-hmm. So he moved quickly to Italy, where he could be in the thick of things.
Yeah. It's a fascinating again, there are a lot of really good biographies on St. Augustine. My favorite one is by Peter Brown. But it's this encounter, St. Augustine's encounter with St. Ambrose, who's the Bishop of Milan, is that decisive moment of his conversion. And it used to be required reading and if you're in any type of great books program, you'll come across it. But it used to be, 40, 50 years ago, standard. St. Augustine's Confessions is a perennial classic.
Right. Yeah. And the great thing about the Confessions is it's autobiographical. So it's a sketch of his life, but it's punctuated with beautiful, beautiful prayers and beautiful spirituality wrapped within this biography. So it's both an intellectual classic, where you've got this intellectual journey of Augustine to the truth, but it's also a spiritual classic in that there's tons to contemplate and meditate, particularly what's within his prayers that he tends to begin and end each episode of his life with.
Yeah, it's absolutely phenomenal. I mean, if you think of like the, if you had to say, well, what are the top five, books, Catholic books to read, definitely the Confessions would be one of them, right? And of course, Sacred Scripture is always just a given, but along with like an Imitation of Christ, I mean, it's that deep and enriching. And I would say it really has the power to really touch your soul.
Right.
And really help us. So Augustine, he becomes, so he converts, and then he becomes a priest, and then eventually the bishop.
Right.
Back in North Africa,
yeah.
And to this day, founded a religious order. There are the Augustinians, and they're still out there. There's not a whole lot of them left men. I don't know if there's women religious too. I think there are, but there's still some Augustinian priests. So those who would be ordained to the priesthood, but then live in a religious order. So with that, let's take a quick break, Mark. Again, you're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy, and stay tuned. We'll be right back. We're talking about St. Augustine.
When you're tired of doing life alone, come back here. We enjoy the company. We hope you do too. Better together. Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to The Catholic Cave. I'm Timothy O'Donnell. In the cave with me, as always, my fellow caveman, Mark Tuttle. And we have the big man, Jim Ganley, who's our production manager today. Let's give a shout out to Kent Blanford, who's normally in the cave with us, who is recovering from an illness. And Kent, we love your brother. We're so grateful that you're getting better and you're getting stronger. We miss you terribly here at the station and here in the Catholic Cave. And we're saving some...
We got a rock by the fire for you here.
Exactly.
Waiting for you to come back. So.
And a rib from a brontosaurus. Better get that soon before it turns, if you know what I mean. Leaving it out. So we were talking about... we've been talking about St. Augustine, some heresies. Mark, I know you want to talk a little bit more about Manichaeism.
Right, right. So this belief that the world is divided into a perpetual battle, an eternal battle
of opposing forces. Equal but different.
Equal but different, and even more than the equal but different as far as good and evil, you have this notion of the spirit world, the world of soul, the world of
the non-material.
The non-material being the good side, and the material world being bad. Which, you know, our world is so Christianized, and that's one aspect of Manichaeism that I think we've so kind of put behind us that it's hard for us to conceptualize to a certain extent. A belief system where creation itself is seen as something evil that traps us and keeps us entrapped. But if you kind of squint, you kind of do start to see that, well, you know, maybe that belief hasn't gone quite away as much as we think it has.
Yeah, there's certainly elements of that when you, like the way you said, when you have to squint to see it, but there it is, you know, it's kind of like, it's hard to see, but if you look really close, there it is. And so, I think it plays out as you and I were talking a little bit during the break. It plays out. It's very prominent in storylines, especially mega narratives that one would find in, say, films or in longer story arcs like, you know, television series. Like I would almost put out there. There's again traces of Manichaeism. Manichaeism in like The Walking Dead, for example, there you have a kind of a clear example because of the dead are these kind of mindless zombies of a putrefaction of the material and how deadly it is.
Well, you know, and as these heresies come back, part of the reason they come back is because we keep making the same errors over and over again.
Why is that?
Well, and why is that is because if you're not well-formed and you start to think about things like the relationship between the soul and the body, for instance, and you come to wrong conclusions about that, those wrong sort of fundamental easy errors to make magnify themselves, and they become bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, when you're talking about Manichaeism in kind of pulp television shows and sort of contemporary one where, you know, actually you sit there and you go, yeah, the whole premise of the show is kind of Manichaean, is that Netflix show Altered Carbon.
Oh, you know, right.
Where the idea is our bodies are just exactly that. They're just flesh. You know, they're just sort of fleshly machines that we can.
Our mind's sort of the water and the body's the cup.
Exactly.
And you just pour it into different cups.
And you can move. and when you think
scary.
Of, and when you think of the when you think of mind in that sense, it really is analogous to the soul. And so you have this separable soul that can go and inhabit any number of bodies, and you know the whole idea, of course, is to escape the bad bodies, and move towards the good bodies.
Yeah, and it's weird to think about that in that show, and that's a kind of thing that's come up in other films, etc. But that our minds or souls or whatever's non-material but enduring part of who we are, our identity, let's say, can be trapped within some sort of sophisticated technology.
Exactly.
And then moved around. It makes you wonder if that's, you know, how is death ever possible then?
Right. You know? Right. Yeah.
I mean, if I can basically be my identity, the core of who I am can be captured within a microchip, you know, then there is no death, right? Right. I'm either powered on or powered off. You know, strange to think about.
Right, and you know the key
and
to
awful
the key to immortality then is to realize this, to learn this truth about yourself, and come to the knowledge of who you really
now
are.
Now you're wandering. You know what though? You're heading towards another super important heresy to talk about, which is Gnosticism.
Gnosticism and Manichaeism.
That's all with us too.
Exactly. But Gnosticism and Manichaeism are very, I think they're very related. They tend to go hand in hand, and one builds off the other. And as a matter of fact, I think if I remember back from classes in the past, I think Manichaeism is classified as a form of Gnosticism, if I'm not mistaken.
It might be. I would have to look into it a little bit more. But one other heresy, and not to bombard our listeners with heresies, but one I want to make sure we talk about because it's very prevalent today, I don't want us to run out of time, it's been given the name, it's formulated different ways, but this idea of a moral, therapeutic deism.
Yes, moralistic therapeutic deism. And that's a mouthful.
Yes.
But where it comes...
What is that?
Yeah, where it comes from, and unfortunately, I don't remember the names of the researchers, but some researchers did a massive poll of just sort of the average belief system of the American public. What is just sort of the general default belief system?
Yeah.
And they came up with the term moralistic therapeutic deism as the three elements. So moralistic, as we were saying, you know, there's good and there's evil, there's good and there's bad.
There's right and wrong.
Right and wrong. And even more important to this belief system, there's good people and bad people. So
which one are you?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Everyone identifies as what?
Good. Well, that's right. I'm a good person, of course.
I'm included.
Right. Of course I'm always included. Person.
Now, I might do bad things.
Right.
But doing bad things never removes me from being in the good person category.
And you can be fooled, and there can be bad people out there.
Which, of course, would be heresy.
They do good things. Right. And of course, is some...
Yeah,
but
even the bad people think they're good people.
Right. And which, of course, is not what Christianity teaches.
Oh, right.
What Christianity teaches is we are all created in the image of life. Likeness of God. So we are all good, and then we become corrupted to various varying degrees. But you know, at least
original sin.
At least as our being, at least as our identity, at least as who we are all good. And we are all called to return to the good.
Yes.
So the world's not
good but fallen.
So the world's not divided up into good people and bad people. Who, of course, I'm one of the good people.
Right. But that's the essence of that heresy, though, is that there's a moral system. So there is some there is a moral system, but it's very vague,
very loose, vague.
And lacks a kind of weightiness to it.
And
that,
it also sort of lacks
life ought to demand of
and
us.
I would say it lacks a certain notion of a moral code either.
Yeah, it's not specific.
The world's divided up into good people and bad people, but as far as what right and wrong, as far as actions do, well, you know, good people tend to do good things. Bad people tend to do bad things. And if I'm a good person, what I decide to do is generally going to be justified and good.
It was, along those lines in one of my ethics classes I was teaching, I like to early on try to get them to try to hold, I just call it just try to hold up a mirror to help the students kind of see, hey, what moral system or moral code do you adhere to? Because, of course, they're not trained in the various schools like utilitarianism, consequentialism, natural law. They don't know those terms yet. But they all have a sense of, these are young adults by and large, and so they're obviously making their way through their days, the world. So they do have a sense of, they have developed a moral code, if you will, on how to make choices and align their choices with they think is good and best. And so I try to hold them near to help them see, because I already got a good feeling of what it is, because the dominant moral code that we live by, that most Americans live by, and especially that age group, would be, it's radical individualism or autonomy
and combined
with consent.
Yeah.
And as long as so that's what drives whether or not something is morally permissible or not. It's, well, are they free to choose, and did they agree to it? And that's it. And then if that's the case, then there ought not to be any constraints. You know, they sometimes will throw in something like, well, and you can't harm other people, which is incredibly vague, and so you have to unpack that.
Right.
But it ties into this moralistic, therapeutic deism that we've been talking about, is that it's a very the primary code, I think, that's out there for many, many, many people in America, or maybe just the West in general, is individual, rugged individualism, autonomy, autonomous persons who are free to choose, and once they give the consent to the action or inaction, that's it.
Right.
That's all there is to it. Well, that is what is a good act, because they're free to choose it, and they did choose it. And if it doesn't work out for them, well, that's on them. You know,
right?
They're sort of like an after. You know, well, yeah, if they, you know, yeah, it's a bad idea to play with a loaded gun, but you know, I wouldn't do it. But who am I to stop them?
Exactly.
Because it goes off.
As long as they
don't learn.
As long as they're consenting, you know.
Right,
as long as they agree to it.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yep.
So it's super. you know, but right. let's move into the therapeutic.
Therapeutic,
though.
Right.
That one's really interesting.
The therapeutic side is the main action of the way they see God interacting in the world. And that is Jesus Christ, the therapist. You know, God is right. there. God is well, there to.
It just almost sounds blasphemous.
Well, it is blasphemous to a certain right. extent. But
you gotta go easy on that.
But
we're trying.
But
to.
God is there to. God is there primarily to help me and to help me out of
oh,
the jam.
Yeah, yeah, the counselor.
The counselor.
It's
exactly.
The counselor.
So,
yeah.
So Jesus is there for me to talk to and help me out and give me advice and give me counsel.
Console me.
And
when things have gone wrong.
And when things have gone wrong. And of course, you know, he does this for the good people. I'm not sure he does this for the bad people, but he does this for the good people, who I'm one of course.
And can't be removed.
Right, exactly.
It's like a tattoo.
So, but yeah, the main action of Jesus is to make you therapeutically sound. In other words, to make you feel good about yourself.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Source of self-esteem. The guy who's always going to hand me a trophy, regardless of where right. I finish.
So when things
no matter how much I screw things up, no matter how sinful I am, he's still going to give me a trophy. Because at the end of the day, I'm a good person.
Right, I'm a good person.
Oh, and that is soothing. Yep. I see the attractiveness to that.
Yeah.
Because I'm never to blame. Right? I'm never to blame. That would be nice.
Yep. And it ties into the deism part of it because deism, yeah. You know, deism's a bit older than the moralistic and therapeutic part of this. Deism, I think, is probably the de facto belief system of the United States from its founding. And that is God is a bit remote. You know, the God isn't the God of Aristotle and St. Thomas Aquinas that is the sustainer of all being or the source of all goodness. God is not an active participant in everything that's happening in the world. God's a little bit remote. And so when God comes out to help us,
I guess you'll have to clean that part.
And so when God comes out to help us is pretty much reserved for when we need him. When therapeutically we need that Jesus Christ counselor.
Oh, right. He's on the bench.
Exactly.
He's on the bench because we're in the game.
Uh-huh.
And then we will call on him as needed.
Exactly. And you
that's
know,
sort of like the wish fulfillment, right? It's like wish fulfillment. And when I have a wish, I need fulfilling. Then I can call on him.
Right. Now, the big question...
Otherwise, you had to leave me right. alone.
Now, the big question, of course, is what does this all have to do with Manichaeism? Because they do seem very different. You know, you've got good God, bad God, fighting it out, matter entrapping our souls that need to be free, and so we need to free ourselves from the evil of creation. What on earth does that have to do with Jesus, the counselor that's there to make the good people feel good but otherwise just kind of stays out of my way. How are these two sets of beliefs related to each other? And so we're going to come up on a break. We'll take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about how moralistic therapeutic deism is really just another manifestation of Augustine's Manichaeism. You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy. We'll be right back.
Radio is one of the biggest tools that God uses to get truth and hope in life.
To get the truths and the promises of God.
Into the ears and the hearts of people driving around.
Into the hearts of people through these airways.
Catholic Radio Indy.
And welcome back to The Catholic Cave. I'm sitting here with Timothy O'Donnell, Jim Ganley, and myself, Mr. Mark Tuttle, hanging out here in The Catholic Cave.
Love it in here.
And we've been chatting today. It's getting nice and toasty, sitting around the fire.
Correct.
We've got the empty rock here waiting for when Kent gets back with us.
So, absolutely.
But we've been chatting about St. Augustine, and we've been talking a little bit more specifically about Manichaeism, the main heresy that St. Augustine fell into, and then therefore the main heresy that a lot of his writings address and point out, because Manichaeism, it was a big set of beliefs back in the late Roman Empire. I mean, a lot of people fell into this trap of seeing the world as black and white, evil versus good, good versus evil, and two competing gods fighting it out. And the bad God kind of being the God of matter and the material world, and the good God being the God of spirit and intellect. And and all of those good things that help us to escape the material world. And so the whole object of life is to get out of this trap that our bodies have put us in. And, you know, Manichaeism had some, they had some pretty weird practices associated with them. They were vegetarians. They didn't eat meat.
Oh, okay.
Yep, so, and that makes sense.
You know, sounds right.
Right, and they also, I'm trying to, one form of Manichaeism that came back was Albigensianism. So,
oh, yes.
Yes.
Southern France.
Southern France, where St. Dominic took up the took up the mantle of combating it. So I get the two mixed up sometimes of what went along with Manichaeism and what went along with Albigensianism. But I think marriage, that the Manichaeists forswore marriage. Marriage was a bad thing.
Because you wouldn't want to propagate.
Exactly.
More material beings.
Right. And that definitely, that more went along with Albigensianism, definitely. Yeah. The avoidance of having children. But Manichaeism also, I think it was more of a, you needed to be free from the ties of marriage to have as many wives and lovers, etc. Which I guess that kind of goes along with just sort of late Roman Empire, you know, life in general.
It was kind of parts of it, yeah.
Yep. But anyway, so St. Augustine became Christian, and then he spent a large time sort of combating this. And so the two main errors that I think are involved in Manichaeism that he addressed, one of which is the separation of the body and the soul. That the body and the soul are not separable, not in the way that the Manichaeists believe. There was no way that you could free your spirit from the evil material world.
Right. It kind of reminds me a little bit of almost where Descartes winds up going, and to a certain extent, this kind of dualism, right, of body, soul, and that, and then the predominant value being placed on the soul or the mind. And that becomes very problematic because that sort of misunderstanding, it opens the door to doing all sorts of things to one's body.
Right.
And I would say a kind of manifestation of that kind of error in understanding of the relationship of soul and body is radical tattooing, scarification, voluntary amputation for aesthetic reasons, all these, excessive and peculiar piercings and all those things, sort of using one's body, turning one's body into a canvas of the odd.
Right, because what's underlying that belief is the idea that, well, my body, the purpose of my body is to express the real me.
So, correct.
So
yeah.
The body itself is not me.
You know, but where that's going to take
right,
us.
Right, but yeah, it's there to
that's
express.
That's
going to
take us right into gender identity.
Yep, exactly. Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Another
yeah,
form
and,
of that.
And gender identity too. I mean, to
the real me isn't my gender that is biologically determined.
Right.
It's something that I imagine or
right,
feel.
Right. Exactly. It's something
it's
that
more
that,
of a feeling. I am.
It's immaterial. And the real one of the goals of life is to free our real selves and to express our real selves to the world and free it from the confines of the material world that has trapped us.
Right.
So I mean very Manichaeistic set.
Well, and it falls right into that moral code we were talking about too, which is any sort of this radical body, alteration is an expression of the radical autonomy combined with consent. Therefore, it's permissible.
Right. Exactly.
Even though
exactly.
It's funny. But it was, it's, again, going back to one of my classes, I would bring up this idea of it's not a thought experiment. It's a real ethical issue, which is that there are they're not many, but there are a few individuals who are interested in voluntary amputation. So having one's perfectly good working legs, for example, amputated at, say, the knee. So that they could be fitted with those prosthetic running blades, because I think scientifically shown that if you're fitted with those, you do run faster. So if you're interested, so those who want to run even faster than they, let's say you've optimized your speed through training and practice, blah blah blah, but you still want to go faster because maybe you're not winning yet or winning frequently enough. There's some who have moved towards voluntary amputation to have those removed. But there's also so that seems a profoundly wrong idea to have one's perfectly good working legs amputated. But the students have a very difficult they kind of recoil at the thought of it. They can't take the next step to prohibit it. That's the problem.
Right, because to prohibit it is to restrict somebody's freedom of choice.
Correct.
And if it's not harming anybody and this
who's it going to harm? It's just going to harm them.
And it's freely chosen. Yeah, they're doing it fully conscious of what's going on. Then, I really can't tell them they can't do it.
Right.
Yep, exactly.
So that's the sort of moral morass that we're in, which basically means everything's up for grabs because, the one sort of loose boundary is – as long as it doesn't harm someone else. Well, you have to really, that's so vague, because we live in a, so then you have to kind of point out, hey, we live in a society. So we're inextricably connected to one degree or another to each other. If nothing else, if you go ahead and perform this voluntary amputation, you're setting an example for others that could make it more enticing, more attractive, therefore more people begin doing it. And you've already said that it's a bad idea.
Yeah, and I think there's also an element of moving away from nature that should lead us at least to question whether this is a good thing or not. You know, that the human body is constituted in the way that it is for certain reasons, for certain purposes, and moving away from what the human body is naturally meant to do and trying to enhance it
human enhancement's a big question.
Yeah,
right?
it brings in, and it goes, I think it goes along with the view that St. Augustine brought up of the difference of good and evil, as opposed to what the Manichaeans believed, where you had two opposing gods, where, you know, Augustine basically said, no, there's just simply good. There's all good, and then there's corruption of the good and a falling away from the good and a not measuring up to the good and a sort of an absence of the good.
Yeah, a deprivation.
That evil isn't a thing. It's not a god. It's not an opposing force. It's a deprivation. It's an emptiness.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
And I think, to in some ways it almost is a foreign way of thinking. For us in modern times, because I think we have been brought up in a world that does tend to see things in a little bit more of a Manichaeistic good and evil sort of way, rather than evil just sort of being the absence of good.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, one thing I want to bring up, too, before we, because we're almost out of time, believe it or not.
I know.
We got a few minutes left. So St. Augustine was an incredibly prolific writer. So not only was he a bishop and shepherd of his religious community, but also he wrote volumes and volumes and volumes of works, from commentaries on the Psalms and sermons and books. And I want to mention, so anything that he wrote is worth reading. But I've heard it said they estimate he wrote something like over 1 million words. And going back, if you're in the 4th century, remember you're not writing with a Bic pen or clicking away on a keyboard. You're using lambskin and blood and a feather.
Honestly, you're usually using a series of servants to write down what you're telling them to write.
So yeah, even they are challenged with the technology they've got access to. But the two books that I would always recommend would be one we mentioned, which is his the Confessions. And the Confessions is pointing towards one's spiritual biography, was what would be called a confession. And then the other one is City of God,
right? And we mentioned at the beginning that when Augustine lived, the great catastrophe of the fall of Rome happened. And so the City of God is his answer to the accusations. Well, this is because Christianity has infected the Roman Empire, and that the Christian set of beliefs has led Rome to become weak. It's led Rome to become compassionate for its enemies, and it's led to bad soldiers. And because of all of that, that's why Rome fell. And so this is his answer back to that. And basically his answer is, no, quite the contrary. Christianity has strengthened the empire. Christianity is goes hand in hand with a strong earthly city to earthly kingdom, and they go hand in hand. And then there's a lot of deep theology involved in sort of parsing that out as well.
Yeah, they I've heard it said. Well, he's a doctor of the church. You should mention that. And he's also nicknamed the Doctor of Grace because, again, from a theological standpoint, his doctrine on grace and how grace builds on nature was instrumental. And so, you know what, though, Mark?
We're out of time.
Yes, doggone it. Just getting started, too. Well, this has really been a fascinating
show. It's been fascinating, and there's so much, too, that we've got to go back and kind of recover some of the topics that we only mentioned bringing up. So I think
we could do like a 10-part series on St. Augustine.
Or at least little aspects of his thought that come up. Exactly. Yep.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at CatholicRadioIndy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to Kent@CatholicRadioIndy.org or by calling 317-870-8400.